It's an exciting time of year, especially for those of us who love physical media. I always end up with a stack of 4K Blu-rays before November is over, thanks to all the Black Friday sales, and I'm here to give you a heads up on Severn Films' Black Friday sale. Of course, this piqued my interest, because they carry a lot of great cinephile deep dives. Beginning this Friday at midnight Eastern, Severn Films' Black Friday sale is live, and they have some wonderful genre titles on offer. We're talking Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral in a world premiere 3-disc UHD release that includes the can cut of the film, by the way. Other titles available include Aldo Lando's Night Train Murders that even comes with the bonus CD of Ennio Morricone's score, the North American premiere of Jean-Pierre Jeunet's absolutely bonkers and hilarious 1991 film Delicatessen in a 3-disc set with over 6 hours of bonus features, and Bruno Mattei's Hell of the Living Dead and Rat's Night of Terror. Whether you want Italian cannibal classics or films from Lamberto Bava or Jess Franco, check out Severin's Black Friday sale, where you're going to get deals on box sets, and most titles will be at 50% off. Severin's Black Friday sale begins a little over 24 hours from right now, and you can find all the deals at severinfilms.com. And Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only highly collectible, it's super pretty, and it's delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. Use the code KINGCAST at checkout to save a whopping astronomical massive 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bad rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
We warm up the old voice box. All right.
Get your sultry radio voice.
Yeah. Barry White, y'all. All
right. I'm into this.
The most erotic episode of the KingCast that has ever been recorded. Somehow without Scott.
Yeah, it's actually a pity.
Yeah, I don't know if Scott would have actually, he would have loved the eroticism, but he is more kinky, I think, than erotic, right?
You know, yeah, he doesn't want romance.
He was
a romance
both.
That man.
He was both. He was filthy and romantic somehow at the same time.
Well, okay. Well, let's get started here, because I don't want to start crying before we start recording. Let's go.
Thinking about Scott being horny is making you cry, Eric.
Yeah, like, but it's not sad tears though. I think it's angry tears.
No, just furious.
How could one man have it all? All right. I'm going to keep all this in. Fuck it. Everybody's going to be so surprised.
That's a really good intro, actually. I think we're done here, to be honest.
That's why God smote him, is because he had it all. The hubris of mocking the gods.
So, hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I am your host, Eric Vespi, and this week I am joined by two very smart ladies to talk about Stephen King's use of, King's use of holidays and the winter season. Temperatures are dropping. Winter is coming, as the entirety of the Game of Thrones cast would say. So it feels appropriate to chat a bit about that here on the KingCast. Joining me for this chat are Mallory O'Mara, the James Beard award-winning author of Girly Drinks and The Lady from the Black Lagoon, and Meredith Borders, a top-tier writer and editor who's made people like me and my late great co-host sound way smarter than we are with her work editing at Fangoria, Birth Movies Death, etc. Welcome, ladies. This is going to be a fun chat, I think.
Happy to be back.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. Didn't Canadian Thanksgiving happen like 2 months ago or something?
Well, yeah, I'm in Germany, and they did their Thanksgiving in October.
Wait, hold on. They have Thanksgiving in Germany?
Yeah, what are they thankful for?
Healthcare?
Yeah, healthcare. There's actually plenty to be thankful for here, but they are. It's more like a family, churchy kind of holiday. So I don't partake.
They're thankful for sending all Nazis now exist in America and not there anymore.
We're free. We did
it. Yeah, you've gone through that phase, and now America gets them all. Yeah, great.
I'm so jealous.
It's pretty rad. I'm not gonna lie.
What a great, hopeful way to start off this Thanksgiving episode of the KingCast. But yeah, this is gonna be an interesting thing. I was talking with Mallory about the whole concept of Stephen King and holidays and how they are so just radically absent from his work. And I think that'd be a great spot to start.
It does seem like a pretty conspicuous omission for a man who's written, you know, over 200 short stories. He's written so many novels. You'd think that at some point he'd be like, fuck it, I'm writing a Christmas book. You know what I mean?
Yes. And like there's one notable exception that we need to get out of the way. And not that the Christmas or Halloween or something hasn't popped up in the background of his stories. But, you know, Cycle of the Werewolf is really the only one where he goes out of his way to really focus on the holidays. As a matter of fact, that's the point of that book. It started as a calendar that Bernie Wrightson was illustrating. And King's idea was to have a werewolf attack, you know, every month, which then means like, OK, he almost always set it around a holiday. Like there's a Halloween one with a heartbroken lady that gets eaten by a werewolf. And, you know, there's Valentine's Day one. And then there's the Halloween one where there's like that famous Bernie Wrightson.
You can be heartbroken on Halloween.
I've done it.
I was heartbroken this Halloween. You could be heart if you're not a coward, you could be heartbroken any holiday of the year.
Just set your mind to it.
Yeah. So what do you guys think about that? Like, what do you think about the fact that like he had one experiment, you know, within his first 10 years of being an author where he was like, let me attack some holidays, and then for the rest of his career, like they're passing window dressing. They're like a chapter in a book or something for the most part. We have a couple examples we'll bring up, but what do you think about that?
I think in some point it's a little bit just a factor of Stephen King's books having such a like expansive view. So, I mean, so few of his books take place over the course of one season at all. A lot of them are, you know, years or generations. And so just by the nature of that, Christmas is only going to pop up every now and then. I will say some of my favorite scenes, or at least one of my favorite scenes by him, takes place during Christmas in The Stand with Tom and Stu.
Oh, I was going to bring up The Stand. I love that scene.
I love that scene so much. It's actually my favorite part of The Stand and one of my favorite things he's ever written. I think it's really poignant. And to me, like, I don't know if he felt this way, but I feel like he could never top it. So he doesn't really need to try.
Right. Can you remind me? It's been a minute since I've read The Stand. What's the context of the scene?
So Stu has been injured on the way to Las Vegas with the other guys. Right. And so he tells them to leave him behind so they can continue their mission.
As Mother Abigail predicted, one would fall, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that also has one of my favorite lines when they leave and he thinks, and he never saw any of them again. And you think that's because he's going to die. And actually, spoiler alert, it's that everyone else does. But he's left with Kojak, and then Tom shows up. He's coming back from Vegas for his like stint as a spy.
Mm-hmm.
And
he finds
Stuart like injured, and he's got pneumonia, and he's, you know, he's really close to death. And Tom nurses him back to health, and he's sort of hearing Nick's voice. You know, Nick didn't have a voice, but what Tom thought Nick's voice would be in his head the entire time, telling him what to do, because Tom wouldn't have known like the healthcare that Stu needed. And so he provides for him, he takes care of him. And then on Christmas Day, Stuart's been kind of like squirreling away all these different gifts for him, just from like stuff that he's found, and he wraps them all somehow, I forget, and gives them to Tom. And it's like Tom's best Christmas ever. It's really beautiful.
In the adaptation, it's really, that scene is really great. I remember Rob Lowe like strolling in on like a rolling cloud of fog, and Tom's so excited to see him. It's so sweet.
It's really nice. I like it so much. I think it's one of his, you know, sweetest moments.
Right.
But I think Meredith makes a great point, is that Stephen King's books are so massive that it would be, because I love a Christmas romance novel. I love a big, big pile of old Christmas smut. And it, I mean, really any holiday book has to take place over a month or a week or even just that holiday. So Stephen King doesn't typically novel-wise work in those kind of parameters. There are some short stories. There's The Breathing Method in different seasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I wouldn't call that a feel-good Christmas story.
Yeah, not in this political climate.
But it is a great example of using Christmas. That's like the feel of that story. You get that story is a whole bunch of like old rich like adventurer club kind of dudes that are sitting around in mahogany, you know, smoke filled rooms telling stories and stuff, and you get that Christmassy feel with the story being told. Like there is a feel and this goes to the debate of like what's a Christmas movie or what's a Christmas story and what isn't. Just because it's set on Christmas, is it Christmas story? Does it have to have a certain feel, right?
Like, I think something counts as a holiday story if something related to the holiday is integral to the plot in some way.
Right, right.
It can't just be set dressing in the background. Like something, like I think Die Hard is a Christmas movie because that Christmas party is the whole plot.
Yes.
And I think If It Bleeds, the most recent Stephen King story that's set during Christmas, is not really a Christmas story. It just happens to be set during Christmas. Right. I don't think there's anything either thematically or narratively that's like really crucial that it be set during the holidays.
No, not at all. Yeah. So I think that's an important distinction. And when it comes to movies, like if the soundtrack has a lot of Christmas music in it, sorry, it's a Christmas movie. It's like, I don't know what it is. If it has Christmas music a lot, then it's that gives me the warm and fuzzies of the holiday season. So that means, yes, the beginning of Jaws the Revenge is a Christmas movie. Maybe not the end, but it's got a shark attack set to a bunch of carolers singing. So
there you go.
If you want to get into the holiday spirit, watch the first 10 minutes of Jaws the Revenge, and please God, do not watch the rest. So
just those first 10 minutes, yeah. You're done.
Well, and speaking of scope, it's kind of interesting because some of his really notable like winter set work, like I don't think they're in the Overlook long. Do they get to Christmas in The Shining? I don't think they do.
I was trying to remember that after Eric
really
asked me. I don't think they do either. I was like scouring my mind for any mention of Christmas, which is interesting because, I mean, I guess maybe the hotel is open again by Christmas, because I'm thinking like, when would a hotel be closed? When would its off season be?
I think it's after Christmas. My memory is that there is some sort of mention, because I think it closes in October or November, right?
Yeah, I think it's the first snowstorm where all everything goes down.
It's their fall, right, when they're arriving. So it's before Christmas that they get there.
I'm pretty sure that we've all clearly
like really thought about this timeline since introducing this topic, and I can't answer it. I really don't know.
That Google's AI says that Stephen King's The Shining is a horror novel set during the Christmas season.
Oh, well, if AI says it.
It says the number 12 is a reference to the 12 days of Christmas. The Grady sisters look so similar that they appear to be twins. What the fuck does that have to do with Christmas?
Christmas twins.
Classic Christmas twins. It's a New England tradition. These twins run around and they beat you in the head with sticks until you give them presents. It's a big New England thing.
Christmas Twins. The Shining was adapted into a 1980 film, which of course means Christmas. This is why you don't listen to AI.
Oh my gosh.
Don't listen to AI, folks. But listen to your family podcasters instead.
I would put money on the fact that I'm pretty sure that the whole timeline of The Shining takes place from like maybe start of November to mid-December at the latest.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something in the back of my mind that's telling me that there was like a brief like chapter where Wendy's setting up the tree or something, but I don't.
In the book, but definitely in the movie, in both movies, I'm pretty sure, movie in the series, I don't think that they're there long enough for Christmas.
Yeah, but that
either way.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, either way, it's obviously insignificant enough that none of us remember it. So I don't think that it counts for the purposes of this conversation.
Right. So legitimately, just kind of thinking about it, the end of Cycle of the Werewolf, just by virtue of having a calendar set story where you're telling 12, you know, one per month werewolf attack stories or whatever, you know, it culminates on Christmas Eve. as yeah. as the kids, you know, sitting up waiting, you know, against the Christmas tree, and the werewolf is makes his final appearance and gets his ass shot by a silver bullet. So,
as is traditional on Christmas, to kill Christmas werewolf.
Would I classify Cycle of the Werewolf as a Christmas story? No, not at all. You know.
No, and it's interesting to me, but I think if you think more about, like, especially Christmas, and like we're focusing on Christmas because that's like the big holiday, but if you think about Christmas stories, so many of them really boil down to like the inherent goodness of people comes out once a year, and that is basically the polar opposite of every story Stephen King has ever tried to tell. So many of his stories are about the inherent darkness in people coming out, whether it's one person or a whole town or the entire world, whatever it is. So I can see him not gravitating towards telling a Christmas story, because just the traditional narrative surrounding Christmas is the antithesis of everything he stands for.
There's that. But you don't have like Thanksgiving stories. There's no, and I don't begrudge that in a novel form, but for as many short stories as he's done, you would think that that would be something that would have jumped out to him as an idea. But my guess is that like the way he writes is more typical of like, here's the acorn of something. Now I'm going to plant it and see what it grows into. Right. Like he doesn't storyboard out, you know, storyboard. He doesn't like plan out. He doesn't outline. And he doesn't do any of that stuff. So maybe it's just in the process where, you know, none of the acorns of ideas have been like, okay, this is set on Halloween. This is set on Valentine's Day. This is set on President's Day or some shit. You know, it's like there's nothing, none of that jumps out to him. It's always character or a situation that burns his idea.
Or the setting is more, I mean, like Mallory said, like the point of a Christmas story is often, you know, the inherent goodness of man. And I think instead Stephen King uses often like the claustrophobia and isolation of like a snowstorm to bring out the worst in people. And so I think, like you said, I mean, he's not outlining, he's not trying to hit a bunch of different popular points that people like to read in their stories. It's just what comes to him. And maybe he's just not like a Christmas guy. Maybe it does not speak to him.
Well,
I do kind of like the idea of Stephen King just hating the holidays.
He turns into Scrooge.
I could see it.
Like, he's kind of that way with Halloween. I mean, I know that he, in the early part of his career, like he would like welcome trick-or-treaters and stuff, but I think he's been on record saying he fucking hates Halloween. And I think not that he hates the holiday itself, but I think he just became so synonymous with being the master of horror that it became a stress event for him to have trick-or-treaters come up and everybody just, you know, would see, oh, there's Steve King and Tabby, you know, happily handing out candy. And it's like, no, you're supposed to do something big and extravagant. You're the master of horror. And he was just like, I don't wanna, you know? So, I've seen interviews where he's just like that. He feels a lot of pressure put on him when the Halloween season comes around. So he just kind of checks out and puts up the, you know, back tomorrow sign or whatever, you know?
Back tomorrow. Yeah. I mean, listen, when you live every day like it's Halloween, you don't need a holiday, baby.
And also, come on, man. I've been to the house that you lived in. You know, you don't put bats and spiders and shit on your gate if you're not willing to embrace the Halloween season. You know, come on, man.
You do have a gate that you can lock trick-or-treaters out with.
Or in.
Or in. Oh, now see, this is a good idea.
See, here we go. But, well, as we've said, it's interesting that he clearly has sidestepped the holidays mostly, but he does set a lot of shit during winter. And I have, as I told Eric before we started recording, I got big thoughts on this. And I think I know why, but before I go into it, I'd love to hear what you two think. I think you hit on something big with the isolation aspect, Meredith.
I'm living, as I said, in Germany now. So I lived in Texas my whole life before these past 3 years, and I'm getting real winter for the first time in my life these past 3 years. And I love it. I'm very excited every time I see snow. It's beautiful. I'm, you know, tired of the heat, but I am constantly shocked at how quickly my dread starts to like escalate in a way that I don't notice until it's really high at how short the days are. Mm-hmm. So it'll be, you know, 4:30 and I'm just like so nervous all the time. And it took me so long to figure out that that's what was going on. And then we got all these smart lights and, you know, we've got the problem under control. But I do think that winter in a place that has real winter is there's a, you know, pervasive atmosphere of dread everywhere all the time. And it is really easy to imagine, you know, phone lines going down, roads are impassable, like what sort of disasters could strike and how I would not have any resources at my disposal to deal with those during like those circumstances. So yeah. I think it makes a lot of sense just on a practical level to set horror stories in the snow. I'd love to hear your kind of bigger ideas about it.
Well, for Eric, have you ever seen snow?
Yeah, of course. I used to cover Sundance, so I'd be.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I grew up in California, then moved to Texas. So, like, we were super psyched. I remember when it was my second or third year in Texas, and we had snow overnight, and that snow was maybe a quarter of an inch. It was a light dusting, essentially. And we're like, oh my God, we can build like a little 3-inch tall snowman if we wanted to. Like, we are experiencing winter. I've never done a true blue New England winter, but, you know, 3 years ago, Texas did get frozen over, and we had, you know, it was significant. It was like 8 feet or 8 feet. It was like 8 inches of snow or 10 inches, 12 inches, something. It was a lot of snow. And then the worst, the freeze, and then the power went out, and I was in my home for 5 days without power. But we're not at all prepared for snow here. So when winter hit here, it was catastrophic. You know, hundreds of people died. Ted Cruz fled to Cancun, and, you know, all of us unlucky motherfuckers that were left were just trapped and waiting for our dog shit energy system to get its shit back together. It was scary. It was like kind of fun for the first day. And then after that, I was boiling water to keep my house warm. Like, I had done a little prep, so the gas tank was full, so I would go out to the car and recharge my phones. But the cell towers were freezing, so I was like having to like do some weird like roaming off of some like random tower somewhere that I had like one bar of service on. So I had that one experience where I felt disconnected, and by day four or so, when nothing was changed, I was like, I don't know. Like, if the things don't change in the next day or two, I'm going to have to try to get out and, you know, get help or some, you know, get rescued essentially, because, you know, that was when I was like, shit, is this ever going to change? Because I couldn't leave. Like, I couldn't drive. The roads were iced and, you know, I didn't have snow tires. We didn't have trucks out there, you know, assaulting the roads and stuff, you know? So, I was legitimately just trapped. So it wasn't just like, oh, the power's out, it sucks, the food in the refrigerator is going bad. It was like, I was literally, the power was out, and whatever I had here is what I got, and hopefully it's long enough, and who knows, it could be 24 hours, it could be a week before we get power back. And it was legitimately scary, yeah.
Yeah, it was harrowing. That was one of the last like seasons I had before I moved to Germany. And I am grateful that they have the infrastructure here and social services to deal with the weather. Yeah. But I always, every time it snows, my first feeling is a little bit panicky flashback to that. Cause I mean, my experience was really similar to yours, Eric. And it's just, I think I remember Scott was like breaking parts of his fence to burn in the fireplace. I mean, we were all in it.
I have to say, quick sidebar, this is why it made me laugh so much works when Scott always used to say how much he wanted to move to Maine. And I was like, bitch, you don't even fucking know. You will die within a week. You will be frozen like Jack in the Shining. There's no fucking way that you will ever make it through. Because imagine that. So the thing about New England winter is it's that from like kind of basically the end of October to April. It is. I mean, I remember winters when I was a kid, when it was just, I mean, we were wearing snow suits or like snow jackets while we were trick or treating. You know, it was like there was frost, it was cold. And then, I mean, there was a snowstorm we had when I was a kid in mid April or the start of April where we got like 6 feet of snow. Like, it's not just the isolation and the cold and the darkness. It's like everything is a fucking pain in the ass. There's a web series that I'm obsessed with by my favorite comedian, Chris Fleming, and it's set in New England. And there's an episode where they can tell that this new couple that moved in is from out of town because they're smiling, and they're like, nobody smiles in New England in February. Like, it's just everything is terrible. You have to get up earlier because you can't just go anywhere. You can't just do something. You have to put on a Christmas Story amount of clothes to go outside. You have to clean your car off. You have to make sure the roads are cleared off. You have to heat your car up. Like, everything takes so many extra steps. It's just such a, it is like the dread is real. Like, it is just like, up until Christmas is fine because it's like, oh yay, snow, it's pretty, Christmas, whatever. But January, February, March, and most of April is just a depression slog. It is so awful. And that's why I'm not surprised there are so many. I mean, what do we got? Shining, Misery, Storm of the Century. Like, there's so many iconic King stories that aren't just set in winter, as we were saying, but really use winter and the difficulties getting somewhere. Like, there's every time I watch The Shining, Kubrick Shining, obviously, like that. Every single time they're talking about how difficult it's going to be to get up to the hotel, and even though there are people who are willing to help them, just getting through those roads is going to take so long. I'm like, I haven't lived in New England in 10 years, but I get flashbacks of like just trying to get to fucking work, you know, because it feels the same way, you know.
How often would you be in the situation where you didn't have power during all that? Because that was the kid, if I had power and internet and stuff, I would lock me in my house for a week. Oh no, don't throw me in that briar patch, you know. But you know,
Eric moves to Maine just so he could stay stuck in the house.
Yeah, if I can be playing my video games and, you know, watching my streaming services and whatnot and throwing on my Blu-rays and. But I turned into like the fucking pioneer woman. Like, I was in bed.
Trad wife, Eric.
It's like when like the only thing I could do during the day was like cook and read.
Oh, making little loaves of bread. You're so cute.
And the only reason I could cook is because I had a fucking fire, you know, a gas stove, right? I had friends that had electric stoves and were shit out of luck, you know.
Oh, I remember tons of times where we lost power. Like, I don't know, maybe at least once a season. You know, it was pretty regular. The phone lines would go down, or the power lines.
How long, though?
I mean, the longest I think I remember, there was an ice storm when I was 18. We lost power for, I don't know, almost a week.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, because I've heard, you know, you hear those stories, and I think that Storm of the Century is actually based on one of those actual, like, you know, Storm of the Century that hit there, and he kind of used that as the backdrop for the story. And like, listen, it's not like it's commonplace now in Texas. It happened once, but that happened once enough that, like, I was legitimately traumatized. I turned 40 years old while I was sitting here freezing my ass off with
nobody.
I was like, this is my big old man birthday, right? And I was just sitting here in, you know, middle of February going, happy birthday to me, I guess. I can see my breath in my house.
Oh, that's
fun.
So sad.
I know. It's definitely put some sad Charlie Brown music against that, and that's the...
Oh, I don't have my slide whistle.
I think to Mallory's point about everything being such a pain in the ass, I think that also is definitely Stephen King's wheelhouse, because my man loves, like, a preparatory scene.
He really does.
He loves it so much, and I feel the same way. Like, give me, like, Bilbo, like, packing his bags for, like, 300 pages, and he never even has to leave his house, and that's still, like, the most exciting adventure story for me. And so, like, the beginning of The Mist, the beginning of Storm of the Century, the beginning of The Shining, there's so many chapters of his characters kind of preparing for this horrible thing that's going to happen, and yet having no idea what the true horror is going to be, and so they can't possibly be prepared for it. So it's like, right. Yes, you know how the boiler works, but do you really know how the boiler works? Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, that's the thing that is frustrating, is that, like, even in New England, even in fucking Maine, where, like, arguably almost any more than anywhere else in the country besides, like, I don't know, Colorado or Chicago, like, they are so used to, they know what to do. They got the trucks ready. Everyone knows how to deal with winter. But even with, I think that's one of the big horrors, and something that I think Stephen King likes to play with, is that even if you are prepped to fuck, it's still a pain in the ass. You know, mm-hmm. it still can get you. And that can be the worst, is that even when you've got chains on your fucking car, you've got, you know, everything set, you've got gas, you've got backup things, you've got a generator, you have everything that you can, it can still take you out. And that is a horrifying feeling.
Yeah. Well, so much so that Stephen King himself has had for what, the last 10, 15, 20-ish years now, has every time, you know, fall rolls around in New England, he goes, cool, peace out, I'm going down to Florida.
You know? See, that's what Scott could have done. He could have been a snowbird.
Oh my God. Yes. He really is. He would have been an amazing snowbird. Also, we have not talked about another big winter book, which is Dreamcatcher.
Yes. Probably yes, the most horrific.
It's a winter is such a big part of that. And that's, I mean, so much of that story, like, it really utilizes the isolation, the pain in the assness, like, the there's so much of that in Dreamcatcher. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff too.
But that stuff is effective. You're right. It is. And even in the movie, it's which, you know, I don't think is mostly works, but I do think that the wintry scenes in the film are effective.
Yeah, you can tell they're actually, those actors are freezing their asses off and it works. You've talked a bit about the isolation of it, but I think that the oppressive nature is yeah. maybe it plays into the tone a bit more with these stories. I mean, I think of One for the Road, which is the Salem's Lot sequel short story that he wrote. And it's, you know, all about a family that gets, you know, snowbound, and the husband leaves the wife and kid in the car and then treks back to the local bar a couple miles away. But it turns out that he broke down right on the outskirts of Salem's Lot. And all the locals know you don't fuck around there after dark anymore. And I don't know. There's something about that story where the winter just... You know how the joke in They Came Together is that New York, you know, is a character in the movie or whatever. Yes. Winter is a character in that one, but specifically the harsh, oppressive, not the fun, beautiful postcard winter, but like the
you're going to That's New England winter, baby. That's
yes, Brandon died. The oppressive, it's oppressive, and, you know, and an evil in and of itself. And and maybe that's, you can only get that from somebody who grew up in Maine and had to deal with all that shit. I don't know, but yeah.
Well, it's a good point.
And like, I had,
oh, sorry, go.
Oh, go ahead, Mallory.
Oh, I was just gonna, you know, it is a really good point, because all these things that we're talking about, like winter, cold, snow, that really is an extra character. And all of these in Storm of the Century, The Shining, mm-hmm. it feels like an extra villain, or it feels like an accomplice to the villain in all of these stories, mm-hmm. or something that the villain is utilizing.
Right.
And I had a little bit of personal experience with it, like perfectly at the Stanley Hotel. It was when the Overlook Film Festival was held at the Stanley Hotel. It was like April, but you're at the top of a mountain, and it was snowing incredibly hard and had been snowing all day and night. And the next morning I looked outside my hotel window and saw nothing but snow. I was on like the second floor, and the snow had completely covered my window. And I immediately felt so claustrophobic, so oppressed. So, I mean, just not being able to see any sky or, you know, the ground, you know, just a few feet in front of you. You know, I was walking in between theaters with my friend Rob, and I would like look behind me, and I couldn't see him, and he was just a few feet away. And just those few days during a horror festival, where this is obviously like the atmosphere I'm seeking, I got sick of it like really fast. So this kind of sucks, actually.
Pardon the interruption. I know we're talking a little bit about Cycle of the Werewolf and Silver Bullet, so I got a nice little bit of serendipity here with our sponsor for the mid-roll. That's right. I'm talking to you about Werewolves, coming to theaters Friday, December 6th. 1 year ago, a supermoon turned millions into werewolves. Now, it's happening again. Fans are howling, "It's a great time at the movies," they say. A wicked alternative to the usual holiday films. Horror, action, and fun. Frank Grillo stars in the movie that bites. Werewolves, get tickets now. In theaters Friday, December 6th. And a little bonus note. Gonna give you some hints. We have the director of Werewolves, Mr. Stephen C. Miller, coming on next week as the guest to talk a bit more about, you guessed it, Silver Bullet. So now, since you didn't skip this ad read, you know a little bit more than the other KingCast listeners do. So congrats, pat yourself on the back. And now let's get back to the show, shall we?
Well, there's so much sensory stuff to it, too. I mean, besides just the feeling of being cold, that the sound or the lack of sound after a big snowstorm when you step outside, it's a very particular type of silence that you it's difficult to articulate unless you've experienced it. It's a dampening. It's a it does feel oppressive. It feels like you are in a snow globe. It feels like you are in a different world. And sometimes it can be magical and fun and cute, but a lot of times, like Meredith said, it's scary.
And it's uncomfortable. I mean, that's the thing is like, it's beautiful and you go out in it, you just want to dive out in it. Then you forget snow is frozen water. And when it melts, you get fucking soaked, right? If you're not wearing all the right protective gear. And when then you're cold and wet.
Listen,
and
that's how that Casper died, okay?
Justice for Casper.
I have a little bit of an honorable mention,
sure.
Which is not written by Stephen King, but by his collaborator and often inspiration, Peter Straub, Ghost Story.
I think
that is the most like oppressively wintry horror book I have ever read. I love it so much. It's one of my favorite books, and I highly recommend it. He wrote it in 78. And also, I think that the sort of, as you were saying, Eric, in which one is it with the, we were just talking about it, the short story with the gentleman and the smoky jackets.
Breathing method.
Is inspired a lot by the Chowder Society and Ghost Story. And I can almost hear that book howling as I read it. I've read it a couple of times and it's a very like sensory book. And it's so oppressive, so cold, so noisy, so stressful. And Stephen King just talked a lot about how that book inspired him. And I feel like a lot of his winter scenes have been, you know, influenced by that book.
Right.
Stressful is such a perfect word. I think that's what we've been kind of circling around is like, it just add like, I think that's the thing that really gets people is that winter is supposed to be a time of rest and relaxing and like, you know, hibernation. But if you live in a place that gets really cold and has a lot of snow, it's not. It's stressful. It's stressful as fuck. Summer is the time of relaxation because you don't have to fucking do anything to drive to the goddamn store. And that added layer of stress, which is why I guess it's surprising to me that we don't have more holiday themed stories or holiday using stories for King, is that it's during a time where we should all be celebrating and, you know, caring about family and whatever the fuck, it's stress. And that atmosphere of like of dread and stress really, I mean, it's very conducive to telling a scary story.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think we keep talking over each other.
I've got a little bit of a lag is the issue. So.
But I think that we're, you know, we kind of unfortunately hit the nail on the head right at the top of this episode where, and, you know, thanks I think it was Meredith for being so smart about this, but, you know, that his stuff, he talks in seasons and not holidays, right? Like his stuff is so long and specifically talking about the breathing method, that is the last novella in different seasons, is it not?
And yeah, it's the winter one.
It's like, yeah, so Shawshank represents spring, and then you get The Body is summer, and you know, and then you get the fall story, and then you get going back to school. There you go.
Yeah.
You know, and then you have the Christmas story, but it's not Christmas, even though it is set on Christmas, it is winter. And he does that, like, and he'll use the seasons in that way. If you look at Cujo, that's a summer horror story. Mm-hmm. That is somebody getting baked to death in their car, right? It's like, you know, he'll use the seasons more than he'll use specific holidays, which I think is really interesting.
I think one of my favorite Stephen King stories that's set in the snow kind of bucks all of the rest of what we're saying here, and that's The Reach in Skeleton Crew.
Right.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with that one.
I haven't read that one.
It's so beautiful. It's really heartwarming. Actually, Eric, I was thinking about it when I was editing your wonderful piece about how Stephen King writes about what happens when you die.
Yeah.
And this is my favorite sort of image that he's put forth about what happens when you die. And it's this 95-year-old woman who's lived on remote island, sort of little tall coated island her entire life. She's never crossed the reach to go to the mainland. Her grandkids are always kind of asking her why. And she just says, you know, I had everything I needed here. I didn't see the reason. But as she's getting older and this really intense winter is coming on, it's the coldest winter since, I think, 1938 or something. A bird arrives at her door and is frozen midair. And she's like, oh, the last time that happened, the reach actually froze. And sure enough, a couple of months later, like you get through December, you get through January, now it's February, and it's still just so oppressively cold. And the reach is completely frozen solid. And all of these people from her past are, you know, have been visiting her and telling her, come to the mainland, come to the mainland. And so she crosses the frozen reach in this snowstorm. And then she's greeted by all of her loved ones who have passed before her. It's so beautiful and really hopeful. And really kind of about, you know, family and the good in people and hope. And it's just not.
So what Stephen King is saying is if you want to have a nice winter, you have to die. That's the only way to have a nice, warm, cozy, lovely hearted winter is to kick the bucket.
Get the fuck off of this island.
Oh, yeah. To leave Maine.
Walk across the frozen sea. Yes.
Yes. That's the only way to do it. I mean, if you look at it from that way, that is completely keeping in line with all of his feelings about winter. Like, I just don't think I don't know anybody who is from New England who gets excited about winter, you know, unless they're a sick freak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of us who didn't grow up with that, we romanticize it. I mean, I know I do. You know, when I pop open the Zillow app from time to time, and I'm just
I know
ooh, what incredible house could I get in Maine? And my Lord, guys, there was this one incredible fucking house. It's right in smack downtown Bangor. It was not right downtown, but it was like right on the edge of downtown Bangor. No, but it was like built by like a shipping magnate in like the early 1900s, and every it has like staircases that all the wood is like they're like art installations essentially, because they're all hand carved by artists, and they have like, you know, faces and shit in it. It looks like a mansion, and it was like $700,000. And to put that into perspective, to get like this, it was like an 8,000 square foot giant thing, and it had like heated driveways and all this other shit, like all this special stuff.
Heated driveways is the first thing you said where I was like,
ooh, okay. Oh,
tell me more.
But it was to put it in perspective, to get that kind of house in Austin, you're talking like a 3,000 square foot house for that price. And Austin is still cheaper than like Los Angeles or in these other stuff.
Also, that house would have been bulldozed in Austin and turned into condos long ago.
Oh, yes, for sure. Still not be there. So, you know, I look at stuff like that I daydream like, oh, it'd be nice. And, you know, sitting with a nice cup of cocoa by the fire and look at the snow. But then, you know, all the realities of like, yeah, the snow is pretty, but then you have to deal with a month of the gross ass gray, black, slush is everything, you know, melts and merges together and refreezes. And, you know, then you realize that like, yeah, that's just nature's trying to kill you every moment of the day that you're there. But I guess you can say the same thing about Austin during the summer when it's like you're on your 120th day of consecutive 100-plus degree weather.
Yeah, but you
it's
don't
like,
have to shovel the sun. That's really the thing. Like, you don't – yeah, I have been to almost every single time I've been to Austin, there has been some sort of insane heat. I think the first time Scott and I went on vacation together, it was like 112 for like 5 days straight. Like they were like issuing warnings. Like it was so bad. But even then, you don't have to move anything. You don't have to shovel. You don't have to clean off your car. You put on less clothes. You know, there is just an element of. I mean, I remember there was a time when I was, God, I forget how old I was. I must have been like 18, 19, but the heat in my car died. But we're from fucking New England and we just keep using shit, I used to drive in a sleeping bag. with like with little holes cut in it with for my arms. But it was so fucking awful. And there were a lot of times where I was driving home one night, and you do have that feeling where you're just like, oh, I could die. Like if I get in a car accident and I'm stuck, like I could fucking die. And that feeling of like, and I think that's what I was trying to say when I was, we were talking about how it feels like another character. It feels like an accomplice to the villain is like, well, the, you know, Jack wants to kill you, but also so does the outside. You know, there's just another, there's another killer in this story, and it's all around you.
Well, as a matter of fact, that killer is worse than the killer that's inside, because it's definitely going to kill you if you go outside.
You can't stab Winter. You can't set the Winter on fire.
Sorry, Meredith, I keep talking over you.
Oh, go ahead. That's okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, being across the sea does have a lag over here. But Mallory, I love that idea of Winter being an accomplice specifically rather than another villain, because, I mean, for instance, it's like how Annie Wilkes got, you know, her favorite author to her place. It's how the Overlook got Jack, and, you know, Overlook always wanted Jack. He was always supposed to be there. None of these things would have happened if the Winter weren't like aiding the serial killer of the story. So I've never thought about it in those terms, but I'm really digging it. That's very
cool. Absolutely an accomplice, especially in the case of Misery, because it's only when the thaw happens, both in the book and in the movie, but in the book, it's even more underlined that when the thaw happens, bodies are revealed, car is revealed, you know, and it's only when Winter goes away that that Annie suddenly feeling the pressure, and she is just floating before that on like total, like nobody's looking in my direction, and it's not until she loses her accomplice that
And he's getting stronger the warmer that it gets. I mean, I'm just realizing this as we're talking about it, but everything in all of these stories, in Storm of the Century, in Misery, in The Shining, as soon as, you know, the storm breaks and everything starts to warm up, the evil loses its hold on the situation and everyone has a little bit more of a fighting chance. Aside from all of the practical concerns of like, okay, now they can call someone, now they can, you know, drive away. There's a more of a spiritual element, like they find sort of their strength and capacity for, you know, fighting this evil coming back to them as the storm subsides.
For sure. Now, it's like it is a mental thing. It gives you the ability to find that grit in yourself to fight again, because you're not fucking freezing.
Now we're all big Dark Tower fans here. I'm struggling. Is there a Winter segment?
It's in the seventh book, The Dark Tower, which I'm currently rereading, and it's Susanna and Roland just trudging along for hundreds of pages through these like frozen badlands, and it is, I think, one of the most depressing things he's ever written, which is really saying something.
I was going to say, brother, that's a race I'd like to see.
So this would be post a lot of very sad deaths, I assume.
Exactly. It's just Susanna and Roland, which is already, you know, it's tough. And it's also interesting because those two are not thrown together, all just the two of them, at any other part in the series. I'm realizing on this reread.
I was just going to say, I can't think of any other time where it's just them.
Yeah, because he pulls Eddie interesting? First.
Yeah, like it'll be Eddie and Roland, or it'll be Eddie and Jake, or it'll be Jake and Eddie, or either of them with Susanna. But this is a chance where you really get to see their dynamic in a way that you haven't seen since the beginning of The Wastelands, where he's like training her in the woods. That's kind of the only other time that it's just the two of them. And then they're just, you know, they're dealing with all of this grief, all of this loss. They don't even really remember why they're still doing this. They can't see any point to what they're doing, but they've just been doing it for so long, especially obviously Roland, that they just keep trudging through. It's a really, really tough read, and it's, I think, responsible for like 10% of that book's length. But it's also, I think, incredibly well done, of course, and really rewarding the way that it does end. But it's, I was thinking about that one
first.
Exactly. You got to make it through. And you as a reader are like, man, when is this going to be over?
He's like, I had to suffer for this, and so do you.
Exactly.
And I guess it's fitting that he saved that for the last book there, because you have like, you know, the isn't It's the fall festival that the Charyutri has brought out.
In
Wizard and Glass, you have, I believe there's a spring festival that's in the Gunslinger that's part of like Roland's childhood backstory, right?
Yes, there's a spring story where they're like sprinkling the breadcrumbs. The Harvest Festival comes back when they're in the Cala, so it's fall again when they're in the Cala. So yeah, it's really the only time that he even in Roland's flashbacks or his memories, winter doesn't really come up until then.
Mm, yeah, and he picks the right time to really twist the knife. Good on you. Sure.
He really makes it count.
He sure does.
So I know this has nothing to do with the conversation, but since we have two Dark Tower nerds on here with me, what do you all think of the fact that King is been tweeting or blue skying or whatever the fuck now about returning to Midworld in some way? Like, it sounds like he's
always
going to.
I mean, yeah. If you look at the thing that's so interesting to me about the Dark Tower series more than any other book series is that it is such a haphazardly written. I don't mean this in a bad way, but it is so organic. The whole Dark Tower series feels like something that grew like a vine. Like it doesn't seem planned. All the books are very very different lengths. They were published just not on a regular schedule. It really is such an organic thing, and I think for a series that is shaped and created like that, he was always going to return to it in some fashion. I don't know if it's going to be a book 8 or if it's going to be a win through the keyhole sort of situation, but I'm not surprised by it.
He even really overtly addresses what Mallory just said in Song of Susanna when when parts of it are obviously them meeting him. But at the end of the book, it's entries into his diary, Stephen King's diary, which I doubt it's actually from his diary. But it's different times that he would wake up in the middle of the night and just be like, go back to the Dark Tower. You've got to revisit the Dark Tower. You've got to revisit, Roland. You've got to write about this Eddie guy. And how times that he just would go, obviously decades or just a few years without thinking about it. And then it would always call back to him. But, he addresses in the diary the way that it was published. And I didn't realize there were these really limited editions of earlier versions of the book that they only put out like maybe 500 copies and then had been out of print until maybe Wizard and Glass came around, and then they reprinted all the rest of them, which I didn't realize because, I'm only 43. I wasn't around for that.
I think looking at the tweets and the way that he's talking about it, he keeps mixing in the territories as well. So my theory is that that Talisman 3 is what he's working on now. And he'd been talking about since Peter Straub died that they had been developing ideas for a third Talisman. Yeah. And I think he's been on record saying that Straub left him with a great idea for it. And I think my guess is that he's going to be folding in Dark Tower into Talisman 3 since he's already did it with Black House.
Black House
is
like, I think, one of the most Dark Tower, non-Dark Tower books.
Yeah.
It deals with it so overtly. I mean, obviously Insomnia and stuff, but I think, obviously like, I just feel like that's kind of generous of Peter Straub. Like, he didn't have anything to do with the Dark Tower, and this is supposed to be a book they were writing together, but he's like, sure, you can write that in there.
It's so, so cute.
I think it's really sweet. I like love their partnership, and I'm so excited about Talisman 3. I mean, that's a world that I will never be reluctant to revisit. And I think that having it tie in even more closely to the Dark Tower makes so much sense.
Yeah. And I hope it gives them the bug and to continue on with something that's specifically Dark Tower related. Just give me a short story. It's fine. Tell me the Battle of Jericho Hill, Steve. Do something,
Eric, but you're making me realize this is sort of blowing my mind a little, but I've been kind of noodling around on this idea that I've often thought about, that time loop stories are, always since since A Christmas Carol, about a man getting a chance to live his life over and over again until he becomes a better person. Mm-hmm. And then on this Dark Tower reread, I'm realizing like, oh, that includes the Dark Tower. The Dark Tower is a time loop story.
Yeah.
And that means that it is in the mold of A Christmas Carol. So you could argue.
Oh my God.
Bringing it all back together here.
Whoa, Meredith, that was beautiful. Oh my God. Perfect 10. She stuck the landing, folks. Yeah. God, damn.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh my God. Imagine Roland getting carried over Midworld by the ghost of Christmas past.
He's wearing like his little nightcap and gown.
His feet are dangling as he.
Yep,
he flips a coin right to flips a coin to a passing boy and says, "Bring me a tuna fish sandwich." Yeah. Well, way to bring it home, Meredith. Thank you so much, and I love talking to both of you. I'm super psyched that we got to have this deeply fucking nerdy Stephen King conversation, and I wouldn't want to do it with anybody else. So I guess now, before we wrap up, is there anything you guys want to either promote or throw a little love to before we wrap up? Or are you ready to just get ready for some turkey?
Buy my new book. My book is out in February. It's called Daughter of Daring. If you want to hear me talk about women in the silent film period of Hollywood and what I think is actually the true golden age of Hollywood, please pre-order it now. I'm going to go on a little tour. And if you want me to come to your city, the best way to do it is to order it and have more people buying it. And tell your local bookseller that you want me to come hang out there. Again, it's called Daughter of Daring.
Hell yes. I'm so excited about it. And for me, just, you know, if you're not already, subscribe to Fangoria. Just go to fangoria.com/subscribe. And, you know, we would love to have you. We're doing some good work there.
Happy holidays.
Many thanks to Mallory O'Meara and Meredith Borders for joining me for that very nerdy and I think very interesting conversation. I like those two a lot. And I also really love when we change gears a little bit and do these deep dives into King stuff. And I couldn't ask for a better duo to do that with. Let's see. Next week, if you listen to the mid-roll, you might already have a heads up on what's coming up next week. But if you didn't, well, now you're going to know. The topic is going to turn back to werewolves as I welcome director Stephen C. Miller on to discuss Silver Bullet. He's the director of the upcoming Frank Grillo fighting lycanthropes flick, appropriately titled Werewolves. I recorded that with him a little bit earlier today. It's a very fun chat. We bounce between Cycle of the Werewolf and Silver Bullet a lot. He's a good dude. I had a lot of fun talking with him, and I think you guys are going to really dig this episode. I also want to remind you that the KingCast Patreon is still going strong. We have over 4 years worth of bonus episodes, ranging from commentaries to interviews and niche deep dives, plus brand new bonus episodes constantly added into the rotation. If you sign up, you also get access to our rowdy Discord. Point is, I make it worth your while if you throw in a few bucks every month. Sign up at patreon.com/thekingcast today and join in on the fun. That's about it. So I'll see y'all next week for some Silver Bullet talk with Stephen C. Miller. And happy Thanksgiving to all my American friends. The rest of you, well, you're probably better off than we are in America, so you don't get anything extra special. We get all the mashed taters and gravy. So you enjoy, I don't know, your freedoms and loving life. And, you know, we're going to get that cranberry sauce. So yeah, that about does it. I will talk to y'all later. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.